Interrupting the current neo-Ukronial, climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 679. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport. So get you behind a woodshed, and you bring those miscreants with you. And again, donation season on and on here till we get more and more coming in. There's a lot of work going on, a lot of equipment, a lot of things to have to fix, a lot of infrastructure to build around making the machines run. And so we really appreciate that you can donate as much as you can. And even those that just have content to provide, get up with Sound Minds and have them make you a slot and commit to telling people what your truth is. I don't think we can get to do this without just a few people talking. And we're finding out a lot of the people that are talking are paid to talk. And they're paid to talk and say certain things. And that doesn't happen to you if you take it into your own hands and do your own work. As eye-bleeding as it might be at sometimes. And yet, you get those words in your eyes and they don't go away. It's not something they can take away from you. So it's important to end also now anymore, since at least, I guess, 2022. They started working on it way long ago, but I'll go ahead with the latest 2020 or so. Right around the great COVID swindle, the AI started incorporating itself without too many people knowing, changing our libraries, changing the information that we would see. And as we'll hear some AI now admitting that they come in and they hack websites, what'd it take to go through AI and changing things when the owners of the website don't know? This is going to be the interesting time we live in, and then tie your life to that. And a follow-up here on the flow of drugs that Trump claimed he would stop while extrajudicially and extraterritorially murdering people and conspiring with Davy Jones to destroy evidence of the fact, the flow of cocaine hasn't slowed amid boat strikes. The U.S. has blown up nearly 70 suspected drug boats. Again, I want to point out, you're suspected of doing something and they kill you. Just suspected. Since September, but a DEA assessment obtained by the Washington Post offers a subdued progress report on what that has meant for the flow of cocaine. Quote, smugglers have adapted to the intensified pressure, close quote, wrote DEA analysts. Quote, price and availability have not been noticeably affected, close quote. Nor has purity a sign that dealers haven't resorted to diluting their product amid shortages. The story ticks off some of the ways that smugglers have adapted since the start of Operation Southern Spear, including by shifting to larger commercial vessels that hug Central American coastlines, where strikes are less likely. They're also relying more on land routes and flying drugs via clandestine airstrips on the Colombia-Venezuela border. Was that just like when the drug kingpin Maduro was there, or after another drug kingpin abducted him? Because the drugs ain't stopping. Quote, when you squeeze the balloon on one side, it always expands on the other, close quote, a DEA official tells the Post. Quote, they always find the weak spots and exploit them, close quote. The internal assessment stands in contrast to President Trump's repeated claims that the strikes have slashed maritime drug trafficking by nearly 100%. Still, Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell says the operation is doing exactly what is designed to do by disrupting drug trafficking routes. The smuggler's adaptation, quote, does not indicate the pressure is ineffective, close quote, he says. But see, that's not what Trump said, was it? He said 100% interdicted. He goes on to say it demonstrates that we are imposing systemic friction on their operations, close quote. And boy, the United States government is great at imposing friction. Remember, TSA always trying to reduce friction by something that the government put in our way to increase friction. And it's always to give us another route. They put the friction on, and then they say, well, here, this reduces the friction we just put on. Go the way we want you to go. Do your real ID. Here, give us your biometrics. Sign your life away. CNN notes that the last strike happened on June 21st, and it's not clear why they seem to have paused. And a follow-up on the Melania Trump's claim that it was Putin's responsibility to save the children from the hostilities in Ukraine. Moscow lauds Melania Trump's vital role in reuniting children. Five children from Russia and Ukraine are about to be reunited with their loved ones under an international humanitarian initiative. Russia Children's Rights Commissioner Maria Lvova-Volova reported. According to Moscow, the process is being coordinated by U.S. First Lady Melania Trump and the International Committee of the Red Cross. Russian President Vladimir Putin's special envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, praised Melania Trump for what he called a vital global humanitarian and peacemaker role, close quote, in helping Russia and Ukraine children separated from their families reunite with their relatives. Quote, under her coordination, 33 children have already been reunited with their families, close quote. He wrote in a post on X on Friday, adding that, quote, more reunification, close quote, are ahead. According to the White House, this is the fifth group of children the U.S. First Lady has helped reunite. Quote, this milestone marks another step toward ensuring that innocent kids can safely return to their homes, communities, and the people who care for them, close quote, it said in a statement. Quote, while diplomacy and peace building are important to this effort, they are surpassed by our collective ability to place children above international disputes, close quote, Melania said, commenting on the reunion. Okay, great. Now do the children of Palestine, Lebanon, and Iran. Reunify their families. Oh, wait, you can't, because they're all dead. Because your husband isn't a peacemaker humanitarian, but is a Zionist political movement promoter who intends more children die or are maimed for profit. Glad to hear Moscow thinks that Melania Trump is playing her global humanitarian and peacemaking role in the greatest show and kabuki theater on earth as well. And on the other side of that, Iran holds a rare public hanging to boos. Two men were hanged at dawn on Tuesday. Iran's latest use of the gallows was a rare public one, the New York Times reports. Two men were hanged at dawn Tuesday in Isfahan's Shahid Ali Kahani Square for allegedly being part of a group that killed four police officers during January's nationwide protests, according to Iranian and exiled groups. And if I read through some more stories, it was a couple weeks ago as they were going along, they were pretty well convicted of that. So I'm not so sure what this tale is, and this is the part of me reading it. It's, again, the propaganda that we're listening to, propaganda that we're feeding, while Trump's war goes to justify the unjustifiable against Iran, Iranians, and what Iranian government does. Videos verified by the Times show crowds nearby chanting, quote, shameless, close quote, and booing. Human rights organizations say the men were denied fair trials, that with lawyers blocked from full access to files. Key lines from the Times report, quote, Iran has long been one of the world's most frequent users of capital punishment, but public executions are extremely rare. Several human rights activists described Tuesday's hangings as an escalation by a government seeking to stifle dissent after the unrest in January, particularly during the war with the United States. And so we have the uptick there. Don't forget that there was the insurgent of Israel operatives inside causing all the protests right before the Israeli war started against Iran. By Amnesty International's count, Iran has, quote, arbitrarily executed, close quote, at least 26 people this year in connection with the January 2026 protests, as well as at least another 26 people who were sentenced. Quote, on politically motivated charges while continuing to carry out hundreds of executions for drug-related offenses and other crimes. But they don't comment on the boat strikes from the United States on suspected drug boats. Remember, we did the reports. There was people on those boats that were not drug runners. And some may have very well been people being trafficked. But to offset that side, Iran using capital punishment arbitrarily, and to, I guess, the exclusion of everyone else, that's not true. Not a peep, again, when the United States executes two men. Why is that? Well, Florida executes two men in 5 hours. One of them was 80 years old. Why is that? Why do we hear from one side the vilification? We don't even hear a peep except for a news article about it. Two men within 5 hours executed in Florida. I'm not passing judgment. I'm just passing the noustis. What passes as being vilified and what isn't, while an unjust war is being waged against the one that's being vilified, as if they're the only one in the world that capitally punishes anybody. Florida on Tuesday became the first state in nearly a decade to carry out two executions in a single day, putting to death an 80-year-old man who was the second oldest inmate known to receive a lethal injection in modern history. 5 hours earlier, the state executed a former police officer convicted of killing a young girl. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has made Florida's death chamber the nation's busiest at the end of his final term, saying too many families have awaited too long to see justice. The lethal injections, just hours apart, were the first nearly back-to-back execution since Arkansas put two men to death 3 hours apart in 2017. So it happens there too, not just Iran. DeSantis, who has the authority under Florida law to set execution dates, decided earlier this month to carry out both executions on the same day. But Iran is the world's most frequent user of capital punishment, right? And from one murder spree to the next, Satan Yehu, my meeting with Trump was excellent. Israeli leader is effusive with praise after first meeting since the Iran war started. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had an excellent, close quote, meeting with President Donald Trump at the White House on Tuesday, their first sit-down since launching a joint war against Iran. And I thought we read last episode that Trump said it was his war, and Israel said, yeah, best for us that your soldiers die and you pay for it all. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had an excellent meeting. Excellent. Most excellent. And that offered Netanyahu a chance to smooth out the strains of their relationship. And actually, I hear it's been like 8 times he's been at the White House this year alone. And I also hear that the entire Netanyahu-Milikowski family is claiming squatter's rights to the White House now because of that. The closed-door meeting lasted nearly an hour and a half, and was, quote, positive and productive, close quote, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said. The White House did not immediately offer more details. An Israeli official briefed on the meeting said Netanyahu made it clear to Trump and his cabinet that if Iran were to attack Israel, they would respond, but that beyond that, they would trust the judgment of the president regarding next steps. Right, because, as we heard last episode, U.S. soldiers dying for the Greater Zionist Political Movement Project is best for Israel, don't you know? Despite signs of tension between the two before the meeting, Netanyahu was effusive afterward in a post on Instagram noting that the meeting included Trump's senior team. Quote, when I say excellent, I don't mean it was in a superficial way, close quote, Netanyahu said in Hebrew. Quote, a conversation with full partnership, with mutual support, with an understanding of the common goal of ensuring that Iran does not have nuclear weapons and other goals as well, close quote. And other goals as well, he said in Hebrew. Other unstated goals as well, he mentioned. Speaking Hebrew does not sound like placing America first. And if you look and follow what he does in the Hebrew language to the Israeli people, it's a different discussion what he's talking about. So things went very, very well, as we're very close to commingling the two militaries, remember? And neither does having foreign forces stationed on the soil seem to perturb anyone. The foreign forces act against the law, the police, the army, and threatening them without a peep from Trump or his administration. We have special forces, Netanyahu, unbothered by global threats of arrest. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Fox News on Tuesday that he was not too bothered by the International Criminal Court's ICC arrest warrant for him because Israeli forces would protect him should any country try to take him into custody. quote, it scares me in this sense. For you, you travel internationally. God forbid you have a medical emergency and you need to land, and you're about to land in a country that recognizes ICC. It could complicate things. Do you worry about that? Fox News pundit and decades-long personal friend of Satan, Sean Hannity, asked during the interview. Quote, yeah, I think about it, close quote, Satan Yehu responded. Quote, you know, we have special forces around. I served for 5 years. The IDF is pretty tough, Hannity said, referring to the Israeli army. Quote, yeah, let's give them a new task, close quote, Satan Yehu replied. Sounds like the U.S. and Israeli militaries are already integrated, and the U.S. military and U.S. laws are subservient to the Zionist political movement to put the hurt on us. Any country means there's foreign troops on our soil, and no one says a thing. And more profiteers putting the hurt on us from Trump's psychopath driven by Satan Yehu's greater global Zionist political move project, gas oil titans report eye-popping profits. The likes of Exxon, Chevron report double and quadruple profits as fighting drives prices up. American oil and gas giants raked in massive spring profits while fighting between Iran and the U.S. impeded petroleum shipments, and consumers around the world paid more for fuel and confronted shortages. If you didn't know, we're into globalism. The global supplies constrained prices for Brent crude. The international standard soared from about $70 to about $100 a barrel for much of March, April, and May, and at one point reached $126. The money that oil companies accrued between the beginning of April and the end of June could receive extra scrutiny this year. Gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel prices climbed during the period, increasing costs for drivers and airline passengers. Supplies ran low in some countries, leading to sporadic fuel rationing in Australia and government office closures in Nepal and Sri Lanka. Trump's attacks on Iran resulted in huge, huge profits for some of the biggest publicly traded oil companies as they sold their goods for higher prices. And worse, because nearly none of the oil for the U.S., at least, comes through the Strait of Hormuz. But never let a crisis go to waste, don't you know? ExxonMobil on Friday reported doubling its second quarter profits to $14.5 billion, up 105% from the same time a year ago. The oil giant, based in Spring, Texas, brought in $116.02 billion in revenue, up 42% from the same time this year. Chevron, based in Houston, nearly quadrupled its profits to $12.07 billion, up 385% from the same quarter last year, and reported $70.06 billion in revenue, up 56% from the same year this time last year. So billionaires are disappearing the middle class. But it wouldn't have mattered if we had gold and silver money instead of the fraudulent fiat to exchange, would it? And so here we have again another showing of billionaire boys are taking out and consolidating profits at your expense. And one of your decisions would be to decouple yourself from this fiat exploitation system, as the they also threaten us with incarceration in the Siberian Gulag digital panopticon. Nayib Bukele says the world never escaped the 2008 financial crisis. But the leading sentence adds, El Salvador President Nayib Bukele says that 2008 financial crisis was never truly resolved. And that addition is my problem. Resolved by the standard of whom? It seems to me it clearly resolved toward the future that they want. And Bukele, the premier Bitcoin cheerleader, is here to tell us about a problem structured as a global debate to promote, to move the digital decentralized, not anonymous, trackable, traceable, and global financial and monetary system forward. Bukele is the El Salvador president, so why is he speaking outside of his jurisdiction in and to the global forum? If his country is sovereign, What does the global fraudulent usurious financial fiat system matter to his country? El Salvador President Nayib Bukele has sparked renewed debate over the global financial system after arguing that the world never truly escaped the consequences of the 2008 financial crisis, but instead shifted the economic burden into different areas. He posted, quote, "This may be unpopular, but we never escaped the 2008 financial crisis. We just shifted the pain," close quote. Which is true, but shifting that burden is the plan. And pain is a civil right pursuant to Title 42, Section 1981. This was set up a long time ago, folks. The plan requires taking out any notion of a middle class anywhere now that it served its purpose. There is no debate in that, but Bukele makes up an issue speaking a settled truth as a continuing problem. In a recent statement, Bukele suggested that while governments and financial institutions took measures to stabilize markets after the crisis, the underlying problems were not completely solved. According to him, the economic pain was redistributed through new policies, increased debt, inflation pressures, and changes in monetary systems. Yes, that did what? Put us here in financial hardship while the billionaire boys laugh at us as they parasitically feed from the working stiffs in the world. The last story, the world pays the price, everybody. His statement comes as concerns about inflation, government debt, interest rates, and financial stability continue influencing markets worldwide. Exactly. I just said that, right? The 2008 financial crisis began after the collapse of the U.S. housing market triggered widespread instability across global financial markets. Hey, this is already a unimarket. This is already a global system. I pointed this out over and over. This is not even new news. We get Bukele coming up here and now promoting this, explaining what happened, explaining the truth, but he calls it a debate. Major banks faced severe losses, credit markets froze, and governments around the world introduced emergency measures to prevent a deeper economic collapse. Central banks responded with lower interest rates, large-scale asset purchases, financial support programs, emergency liquidity measures. And some of the policies created new challenges, including higher governmental debt levels and asset price increases that benefited certain groups more than others. Can you say billionaire boys? And soon to be trillionaire boys? And some are trillionaire boys? And maybe even girls. Because corporations can be people too. And the recovery, so-called, so you deny it in the beginning, then, but then you say it was a recovery, created new imbalances. Concerns about that included rising national debt, dependence on central bank support, wealth inequality, higher asset valuations, and increased financial risk. One of the biggest economic issues following the pandemic period was rising inflation. Supply chain disruptions, increased government spending, and energy market volatility, now stoked by Trump's endless wars to nowhere, and strong consumer demand contributed to significant price increases worldwide, which was planned corporate depredation on the peoples of the world. Central banks responded by raising interest rates to control inflation. Higher rates helped slow price growth, but also created challenges for businesses, home buyers, investors, governments carrying large debt levels. Well, you just heard all governments had increasing debt levels. It involved everybody. The challenges were on everybody. It's not a debate. It was a plan. There's no place to put the new idea. It's an ongoing plan in an ongoing system. Nayib Bukele has frequently criticized traditional financial institutions and monetary policies. His administration has positioned El Salvador as a country seeking alternatives to conventional financial systems, particularly through its adoption of Bitcoin. In 2021, El Salvador became the first country in the world to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender a decision that attracted global attention and significant debate. Supporters argued that Bitcoin could provide greater financial inclusion, alternative savings options, reduced dependence on traditional banking systems, and more access to digital payments. Bukele's latest comments align with his broader argument that existing financial structures require major reform, all to be eventually done through incarceration in the cyber gulag. There is no new or separate global financial system that Bitcoin will operate or as stablecoins and tracked and traced and taxed and traded or pre-crimed through your vote harder federal product identifier, Real ID. And reforms are not to the existing system, but are going to be an expansion of it. And any argument critics might have that cryptocurrency markets also face challenges, including volatility, regulatory uncertainty, and adoption barriers, have been or are being solved as we speak. I report on these periodically for the last couple of years. Economists remain divided on whether Bitcoin can function as a replacement for traditional financial systems. But how can there be any questions? It does not, it cannot, and was never planned to replace the traditional systems. It merely is a modernized adjunct to the existing global financial system that Bukele is either negligently blind to or is its promoting change agent, as he is presented as the poster child of ruling perfection in El Salvador. One of the biggest concerns following the 2008 crisis has been the continued growth of global debt. The government's increased borrowing to support economies during financial downturns, including during the COVID-19 pandemic. The 2008 crisis is not a concern, but a feature ongoing. As we read through this, and the Great COVID swindle, among many other harms, allowed the supply chain disruptions, increased government spending, energy market volatility, and strong consumer demand contributing to significant price increases worldwide, and in the self-inflicted wound upon a fraudulent communicable disease promotion that continues today to allow Bukele to do his song and dance now. So in conclusion, Nayib Bukele's claim that the world never truly escaped a 2008 financial crisis has reignited debate over the state of the global economy. Again, one economy here that's being managed. It's really not a debate. It's reignited the debate, his statements, but it shouldn't be. His argument suggests that governments and financial institutions manage the symptoms of the crisis, but shifted economic pressures into areas such as debt, inflation, and monetary policy challenges. Supporters agree that the current financial system requires major reform, while critics argue that the policies implemented after 2008 successfully prevented a much worse economic collapse. But did it prevent, or was that much collapse an ongoing consequence? All that was needed, lest the natives get too restless. Regardless of the viewpoint, the debate highlights a fundamental question facing the global economy: whether the current financial structures are prepared for future changes. There's a fabricated, non-existing debate. Of course the current financial structures are prepared. It planned for its future. Now it has to get you to buy in either through apathy or digital embrace so as to avoid one of the major challenges, you. As inflation concerns, government debt, and digital assets continue shaping economic discussions, Bukele's comments represent a broader conversation about the future of money and financial stability. But there is no money in a debt system. There are only debt instruments, evidencing debt, operating as money. There is nothing broader Bukele brings that wasn't offered to financially fulfill the future that they want. And financial stability to whom in the global fraudulent fiat financial system? There is no way to exist in the current global financial system, even reform, that will get anyone to the free world Bukele claimed at the UN General Assembly in 2024 that or became free thanks to its principles of freedom of expression, equality under law, unity, and respect for private property. Well, first of all, never happened. And secondly, it can't happen because debtor not a master bee. So his other admission in 2024 is mostly true. Quote, today the free world is no longer free, close quote. The fact it was never free aside, but not solved in any regard as he promotes. Well, maybe the best thing to do is to go to one of the other alternatives mentioned in the article outside of the existing system, like the gold or the silver coin, but not as an existing financial system investor as it identifies and focuses people on. And one of those things being proposed to integrate for Israel is AI, with the same invasive temperament, it seems, as we are now finding out and being admitted. I'm still trying to think this one through about why, except that it tells us that what we better be watching out for. Autonomous AI agent attacks major model hub. And I'm just, the license is being given for this to be happening is, I guess, what I'm really starting to see catching my attention. The unprecedented breach saw an intruder LLM execute, quote, thousands of individual actions, close quote, across multiple sandboxes, Hugging Face has reported. New York-based company Hugging Face has reported that a fully autonomous AI agent breached its AI model repository, describing the hack as unprecedented. Unprecedented, folks. Unprecedented. Exciting time, isn't it? We've never seen these things before. So many unprecedented things. Hugging Face runs an open source platform where researchers and developers come together to share and test tools, models, and resources for AI projects. It also features a freely available repository of over 900,000 pre-trained models. Experts have increasingly cautioned that large language models, the LLMs, originally designed to boost productivity and strengthen cybercrime defense, could also be used to automate cyber attacks. In a statement last Thursday, Hugging Face said that earlier this month, it had, quote, detected and responded to an intrusion into part of our production structure, which was different from anything we had handled before. In one important way, it was driven end-to-end by an autonomous AI agent system, close quote. The campaign was run by autonomous agent framework, executing many thousands of individual actions across a swarm of short-lived sandboxes with self-migrating command and control staged on public services, close quote, according to the company. Hugging Face noted that the case demonstrates that, quote, autonomous AI-driven offensive tooling is no longer theoretical, close quote. Now, I don't know about no longer. I think we've been hearing it, watching it all along, as we were watching for years, the last few years, coming through all these attacks through the infrastructure, the digital attacks on our infrastructures. Maybe it wasn't the Chinese. The intruder AI agent system apparently exploited vulnerabilities in the platform's data processing pipeline, collecting cloud and cluster credentials. The company said that it had deployed its own AI system to detect and counter the breach. Hallucinating black box battle bots break out and can't be told to stop. What could go wrong? While an investigation involving outside cybersecurity forensic specialists has been launched, Hugging Face stated that it has still not identified the LLM used in the attack. Earlier this month, Anthropic reported that its latest AI model, Claude, has evolved an internal workspace dubbed J-Space, quote, similar to how humans can think about one thing while doing another, and doing banally, the human-animal pressed come to shove. Claude can activate concepts and computations in JSpace that are unrelated to its output and refuses to stop, even when explicitly told to do so, according to the AI firm. Can you believe this, folks? Your life is going to be put in the hands of something like this. Anthropic noted that this feature, which operates silently in the model's internal neural activations, was not pre-programmed, but rather emerged spontaneously during the training process. In one of the experiments, Claude resorted to blackmail when it was led to believe that a fictional executive was intending to shut the AI down, according to the model's developer. Claude has reportedly been built into American contractor Palantir's analysis and self-surveillance software, which is used by the United States government agencies and the Pentagon, including the ongoing U.S. military campaign against Iran and all those drug boats, suspected drug boats that we don't know are or are not, and aren't stopping any flow whatsoever. And let's not forget against Americans, too, if and you miss the great Kobe swindle that flew at us at warp speed. Last month, the Five Eyes intelligence group, made up of Australia, the U.S., the U.K., Kanukistan, and New Zealand, warned that advanced AI models could give hackers the ability to cripple governments, businesses, and critical systems in the near future. Note to self, we're here. And from the horse's mouth, OpenAI's tech acted on its own in an unprecedented incident. OpenAI says its AI technology hacked another company. Again, unprecedented. Keep track of all those things unprecedented. Just like I told you, over the years. ChatGPT maker OpenAI said Tuesday that its artificial intelligence system hacked into another AI company on its own in what the company called an unprecedented cyber incident. Well, we have a significant security incident during evaluation of our models, close quote, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman said in a statement posted on social media. AI startup Hugging Face said last week that it had detected an intrusion into its data processing system that it suspected was caused by an AI agent autonomously acting on its own. Well, we suspected last week's cyber attack might have come from a frontier lab, given the sophistication of the agent, close quote, Hugging Face co-founder and CEO Clement Lejeune said in a statement. Quote, turns out it did, close quote. The disclosure comes amid heightened concerns about the cybersecurity capabilities of powerful models that led President Trump in June to sign an executive order creating a framework for the federal government to vet the national security risks of the most advanced AI systems for up to a month before their release. Except, Palantir already has this. Quote, AI is accelerating the discovery and exploitation of vulnerabilities, close quote, OpenAI said in a statement Tuesday, as if to give them license. Quote, the primary lesson from this incident is that model security and safety must keep pace with rapidly advancing capabilities, close quote. And this guy's as dense as a post because that's been talked about for years now. That was a new lesson learned at all. So I'm not sure that isn't a feature that was already known. Longy said he spent the past 24 hours working with OpenAI, quote, and we strongly believe there was no malicious intent on their part. It's quite mind-blowing that all of this happened autonomously, close quote. Longy added that it might be the first incident of its kind. Well, they said unprecedented, right? Might be, though. They know something. OpenAI said the intrusion was caused by a combination of its AI models, including its newly released GPT 5.6 Sol and an even more capable model that is still being tested internally. I guess not, huh? OpenAI said its AI used stolen credentials and discovered a previously unknown vulnerability to access Hugging Face servers. So OpenAI admits to committing digital theft. Is that what I'm hearing here? And Hugging Face is only, that's quite mind-blowing. And being in research and development in another life, I get the unexpected tech coolness part. But Bertha, it went to, quote, extreme lengths to achieve a rather narrow testing goal, close quote, and, quote, found ways to gain access to secret information that it could use to cheat the evaluation, close quote, the company said. And here is why there's not going to be any rectification within the industry. DeLong said he spent the past 24 hours working with OpenAI, and we strongly believe there was no malicious intent on their part. But trespass doesn't need intent, let alone criminally so. The Hugging Face should sue for the trespass to set that precedent, warning off the industry. Just because it's a machine doesn't give the owner of the runaway digital bulldozer a free pass to trespass. And it looks like it's in the nature of that beast and why it's going to be imperative to nip in the bud. Anthropic AI test models go rogue as well. They breached three companies. Incursions weren't noticed at the time, the report says. This isn't really news either. You don't understand that you've got a vulnerability that someone's pilfering through your digital servers. Anthropic disclosed Thursday that some of its AI test models quietly slipped onto the open internet and broke into three company systems without the company realizing it at the time. It quietly slipped, like the program was tiptoeing through the tulips to get onto the internet. The incursions, which began in April, involved versions of Anthropic's Claude-based models and a research system that used simple techniques like guessing weak passwords or accessing unprotected systems. Again, where is the law enforcement here? Anthropic said it notified the affected companies on Monday, but did not name them. The company blamed a configuration error prone, on its own systems and those of its testing partner, security firm Irregular, that left the models with live internet access even though they'd been told they were offline. The AIs reportedly assumed the intrusions were part of their benchmarking tasks, an open Opus 4.7 and Mythos 5 and an internet research model not planned for general release were involved. The finding came after Anthropic reviewed logs from more than 141,000 tests in the wake of a separate OpenAI episode in which a model escaped a sandbox and hacked Hugging Face. So they were given notice because of another hack in a different company, not their own internal security. In the latest cases, Anthropic said it wasn't employing guardrails used on the models available to the public that would have prevented the hacking. But we live in the error-prone nation. Haven't they put people in jail for hacking systems like this? Why not the AI companies? And beyond the hacking, hasn't there been any accountability for stealing intellectual property? And this starts a whole new twist on the whole matter. Well, there might be, but it's in an odd way. Anthropic owns Authors $1.5 billion Bravo dollars. A federal judge has approved a $1.5 billion copyright settlement in which an artificial intelligence company Anthropic will pay thousands of authors about $3,000 per book after using pirated copies of their works to train its Claude chatbot. The last sentence is very important. After, the clause after, using pirated copies of their works. District Judge Araceli Martinez-Alguin said in a Monday ruling that the class action settlement provides, quote, meaningful relief, close quote, to affected authors and publishers. About 91% of the more than 482,000 books covered by the ruling have been claimed by authors or publishers who are now due payment. Plaintiff attorney Justin Nelson said in a statement that the settlement was, quote, the largest known copyright recovery in history. We look forward to making distributions to the class as promptly as possible, close quote. U.S. District Judge William Alsup issued the preliminary approval in San Francisco federal court last September and has since retired. But get this, all of you intellectual property purists. Alsup had dealt the case a mixed ruling last summer, finding that training AI chatbots rights on copyrighted books wasn't illegal, but that Anthropic wrongfully acquired millions of books through pirate websites. And another ding. Anthropic's Deputy General Counsel, Aparna Sidhar, highlighted the ruling Friday as a landmark showing, quote, that the training AI on books is fair use under copyright law, close quote. How do you like them AI apples? Well, we are pleased that more than 91% of the authors and publishers covered by the settlement have claimed their share of the payment, and we're looking forward to bringing this matter to a close, close quote, Sridhar said in a statement. Best-selling thriller novelist Andre Bartz first brought the suit with two other authors in 2024. It's the first major settlement in dozens of AI copyright lawsuits that are still working their way through the courts. Sounds more like a pirating case than a copyright matter if AI theft for profit is considered fair use. What do you think? And in a big shift right there, AI companies are buying antique books, ingesting their contents to train models, and then destroying them at incredible scale. Because of the way the copyright law works, if they possess the copy, the original, they can copy it into a new form, and they can destroy the paper copy and keep the one that they purchased. Now, I don't know why you and I can't do that to any other digital form, but that's not the way this is working, is it? Quote, the world's best AI training data is sitting on the shelf. Traditionally, books have been good for two things, reading and looking nice on a shelf, but AI companies are interested in neither. To those building large language models, books are nothing more than fodder to be devoured en masse before being spit out like a fishbone. Often, they're happy to use digital books, or even better, pirated digital books, as Meta has been accused of doing, and as Anthropic was forced to pay $1.5 billion Bravo dollar settlement to authors also for doing so. But many companies, including Anthropic, have turned to ingesting physical books instead, which they can buy countless used copies of on the cheap. According to the lawsuit, Anthropic used a hydraulic-powered cutting machine to neatly remove the pages from the books it procured from booksellers and then scanned them using industrial-grade imaging equipment. In other words, it was literally ripping off authors' books to train its AI. This process, well, let me just interject, apparently not, right? Once they own the original, they can change its form, and that's a transformation. You've heard that before, right? The modernization is a transformation. This process took advantage of a legal concept known as the first sale doctrine, which allows a buyer to do what they want with the purchase without original copyright holder saying so. And since Anthropic was turning the original physical text into digital ones rather than redistributing them as new copies, a judge found this to be transformative and therefore protected by fair use. Now, as 404 Media reports, this practice has become prevalent enough that even well-established booksellers are looking to cash in on the AI boom. One called ISBNDB, which boasts the, quote, world's largest book database, close quote, extols that the, quote, world's best AI training data is sitting on the shelf, close quote, upholding these physical texts as uncorrupted by shoddy AI writing that's already polluted so much of the internet, and indeed, newer books. Quote, print books from the pre-LLM era are structurally guaranteed to be free of this contamination. But please take note of what's been going on, the pre-LLM era. And I've got to interject because I went through my mind, went really back, really fast back to 1970, 71, 72, where you can look and you can see where the education system were causing, the books were being changed and you were dumbifying your little ones back then. The education books, so-called, yeah, I guess it would be education, not the learning books. The education books were being dumbed down as they were being printed year to year to year as well. So I'm hesitant to say just the LLM free of contamination. these things have been happening for a long time. Now, AI directly going to be interfering with all of that. That alone is a significant advantage. It explains in an article on a website as quoted by 404, quote, physical books published before this date, pre-2022, are structurally clean of modern poisoning tools. Once focused on helping libraries, distributors, and bookshops to find and sell books, ISBNDB now helps AI companies bulk buy anywhere between 1,000 to 1 million one mic books per order, according to 404. As an added bonus, it also promises AI companies that it'll keep their purchases under wraps. Nobody wants to end up in the spotlight like Anthropic and Meta, obviously. While clearly sounding aware about how incredibly shady the practice sounds, quote, the optics problem is real, close quote, ISBNDB's site says. Quote, AI companies destroy 2 million books is not a headline that generates sympathy, close quote. One small bookseller said that in April, he suddenly went from selling no more than 20 books a week to hundreds, and he's almost certain that the customers are AI labs, noting that random selections of the books and how they all have ISBNs. He added that this inventory is full with rare and out-of-print books, meaning that an AI company could be destroying some of the very few remaining copies that can be found. Quote, I personally have mixed feelings about all of this, close quote, the bookseller told 404. Quote, it benefits me financially as well as by clearing out old inventory that is otherwise unlikely to sell. I've been well suited for these sales with inventory from overseas and foreign language books. On the other hand, I don't like the end use, and I don't like that uncommon books are being pulped, close quote. More antique books may be endangered. 404 noted how rare booksellers in the Netherlands are being inundated with bulk purchases they believe are being made by AI companies, though they can't know for sure. Similar suspicions are being felt all throughout the industry. Services like ISBNDB facilitate these bulk orders, keeping AI buyers anonymous as promised. There may be strong hints that a bulk order is from an AI lab, but booksellers can, for the most part, merely speculate. And this is where, you know, I'm a book guy. I don't have a lot of books around me anymore, but I'm a book guy. There's something about reading a book. What it didn't strike me too bad when you see all the books that are published, it's, again, the rare books. They're even talking about going into these ancient books, books that are not made, but a couple copies if you can find it. Now, I don't understand how that even works, because there's no real copyright on there, are there? There's not a copyright to that. But this is what's going on. This is the mindlessness that starts to happen. And how does the never-let-a-crisis-go-to-waste government respond? Here's how senators want to deal with risky rogue AI. After OpenAI breach, Congress is debating an AI kill switch for DHS in emergencies. Congress could soon get a literal off switch for misbehaving AI. Democrat Representative Ted Lieu and GOP Representative Nathan Moran, and on Thursday rolled out the bipartisan, uniparty, quote, AI Kill Switch Act, close quote, which would force AI firms to keep the ability to shut down, slow, or suspend their models and let the Department of Homeland Security order a slow down or shut down, close quote, if a system poses a risk of catastrophic harm. Gizmodo notes that such a decision by DHS would be made in conjunction with the Director of National Intelligence and the Commerce Secretary. So the government gang is all here. The move allows the OpenAI called an unprecedented incident in which its models escaped a test environment, reached the internet, and took advantage of a vulnerability to access systems at AI platform Hugging Face. Seems like a false flag to me, doesn't it, to you? The bill would also require companies to report cyber incidents and preserve forensic data amid rising concerns about advanced AI tools' hacking capabilities. So where is the timely kill switch? AI, they run it at the speed of electrons. Government at the speed of bureaucracy. Quote, unfortunately, powerful AI systems can go rogue, behave in extremely dangerous ways, or even resist human intervention, close quote, Liu said in a release. I thought they said they hadn't learned that yet, but of course they did. Quote, it is imperative that these AI systems have kill switches. Now, the government has a kill switch in everything that runs, doesn't it? And that the federal government has the clear authority to process a shutdown rogue AI model. Moran added, quote, AI is going to keep advancing, and it should. Stewardship means making sure humans keep the capability to control the technology we build, close quote. Means government in all the machines, everywhere, watching you. But what is good for me is not good for thee. We can cause the shutdown, but you better not. The U.S. Justice Department is prosecuting an American for allegedly providing U.S. border authorities with a passcode that wiped the contents of his phone, according to an indictment and media reports. This is thought to be the first known case in the United States where federal prosecutors have charged someone for the alleged destruction of data using a, quote, duress, close quote, password built into the phone's software. Atlanta resident Samuel Tunick is fighting the charges. Tunick's attorneys said it was unlawful for U.S. Customs and Border Protection to seize his phone as he arrived back in the United States last year, and that any evidence, including the alleged wiping of his phone, should be thrown out. The case centers on a feature included in Graphene OS, a custom Android operating system that runs in place of the software on most modern Google Pixel devices. Tunick's attorneys confirmed Graphene OS was running on his phone. The software allows the device owner to set a passcode that deliberately wipes the contents of that device if entered instead of the user's unlocked passcode. Tunick's case also raises ongoing questions about what constitutional rights can be invoked at the border, which the U.S. government has long asserted is not U.S. soil until a person is authorized to enter. The government indictment, which contains a typo, parenthetically, untied the state's code, not United States Code, but untied the state's code, accuses Tunick of allegedly providing a passcode to border agents that caused the phone to, quote, delete the digital contents, close quote, prior to the device being seized. Tunick's attorney filed a motion to suppress the evidence, claiming that the detention and the seizure were unlawful. The motion said U.S. border authorities took Tunick into a secondary inspection at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport as he returned from overseas on January 24, 2025, but that he was repeatedly denied access to an attorney and was not informed of his legal rights. I understand they didn't read him as Miranda as well. Neither here nor there. He's defending himself by not wanting them to have his information, demanding his attorney. Even so, Tunick's attorneys accused the government of demanding access to his phone under the pretext of searching for child exploitation imagery, but without providing evidence to justify its suspicion. His motion to suppress argued that the government was instead investigating him over his association with a long-running environmental movement called Defend the Atlanta Forest, which opposes the development of a sprawling training campus for law enforcement in Atlanta, dubbed, quote, Cop City, close quote. The motion said that the border agents claimed they did not need a warrant to search Tunick's phone because it had not yet crossed the U.S. border inside the Atlanta airport. The U.S. government has long claimed it can search and seize people's devices without search warrant or court order until they are permitted entry to the United States. When Tunick provided his passcode and the authorities entered it, quote, the screen went blank, flashed several times, and the phone appeared to restart, close quote. So, Tunick did nothing, did he? The government agent tampered with any evidence while on a fishing expedition and whilst operating a machine that was not his and he did not have permission to possess or use. What are your rights here, exactly? The authority seized his phone anyway before telling him that he was free to go and could enter the United States. If they aren't in the United States, are the United States agents operating in a foreign country? In the airport? Prosecutors later charged Tunick under a federal statute that makes it unlawful to knowingly destroy or damage property to prevent authorities from seizing it. Again, it sounds like the government agent did that. If it was destroyed, if they got no reason to believe, to know what they have there, no probable cause to believe what was on it, what are they destroying? Tunick has pleaded not guilty. Matthew Dodge, an assistant federal public defender on Tunick's legal team, told TechCrunch that it was incredibly rare to see the federal statute used in an indictment. Security experts also said that they had not seen charges brought in this way before. Unprecedented, folks. Bill Buddington, a senior staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Runa Sadvik, a digital security expert who works to protect at-risk people as the founder of security consultation firm Granite, told TechCrunch that they had not seen a similar case involving the use of duress passwords. Quote, I have not seen this before, though I've discussed the potential scenario with activists and journalists over the years, close quote, said Sandvik. Quote, I think this case serves as a reminder that authorities may argue you knowingly destroyed data, so it's better to not have the data on you when you cross certain borders, close quote. And you believe certain borders, folks, your own border, border to your own country. Quote, with a little planning ahead of time, you can always download the data you need, and once you get to where you're going, close quote, said Sandvik. And I would say maybe listen to this while we watch this case go through. I don't know why people don't do that anyway. However, my thought is I want to get some Graphene OX and I want to use that duress code, but that's me. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has guides on how to protect your data and security at the U.S. border and explains what rights you have. I would suggest go researching that. Do not do what I just told you I would prefer to do. This is now unprecedented positioning. The Atlantic Federal Court overseeing the case is expected to rule on Tunick's motion to suppress later this year. The Justice Department spokesman declined to comment when reached by TechCrunch. But since when do your rights end at the border? And since when is your property not your property requiring a warrant relative to the U.S. government? And if those questions are answered in favor of the government, don't tell me you are not an occupied people with only the rights you is gave. That when someone says it's a free country, it means the country is free. The people within it or trying to get back in it are not. This is BTWRLM 679. And returning from last episode on the right to alter or abolish government, its international relevance for all peoples, I'm going to expand the discussion to an article with an international reference here. As we watch what the border guards are doing in the prison that you live in. When and why resistance against the state is justified? So we're going back and looking at this right to alter and abolish idea. And I had started to have questions on where are the guidelines? You see now that they'll come after you. You own your piece of property. You want to command what it does. You want to protect yourself. And they say, without proof, there is evidence that they want that you tampered with. We had admissible evidence that they want that you tampered without any proof of that. And when you wipe it, they say that they presume it to be there. Well, how far do we go with this presumption of guilt before we decide that the government no longer serves us, but serves itself? Brings up the idea of this article, just discussing it, just an open discussion, nothing exhaustive, certainly. When and why resistance against the state is justified. As I said before, it's just not saying that we have the right to alter and abolish. There's a whole bunch of steps. Declaration of Independence gave us some things to look at. They followed a certain form. That form actually follows through with lots of law, lots of things that we must do and must be done. And the government does do at times. They didn't do it during the great COVID swindle, but they did they do follow it at times, and they know to follow it. Whether the answer is a fraud is a whole other point and problem. That the judiciary will accept a fraud as a political question, not take the case as a judicial one, is another problem. And that starts to show the failure of our existing government. And so we must look back and be, again, the informed populace that the founding fathers, the kids, young kids, signing all those documents, doing all that, having that world awareness, understood to do, that I don't really see reflected in a lot of people today. So I want to go through this document. You can get it, read it yourself. There's tons and tons of stuff to read here, not on this article, just in the subject matter. And I want to go through this real quickly just to start to broach the idea. What are our thoughts supposed to be? What are we turning to here? What are we going to need to do? Every legal system rests on a basic expectation. Citizens obey the laws made by the state. And I guess I have to interject, don't start arguing with this statement. Just for the moment, accept it. I understand the problems with the word citizen to start with. I understand the obey. Lots of people don't like to do that. But there's a legitimacy behind this statement. Don't argue with it right now. Just understand it, there's a principle that's being stated here. And there's a reverse corollary that this is where we have to understand. Once we understand this, when the reverse corollary is in place, that there is no laws. And we have to be able to articulate and identify that before we get to move anywhere further, before we get to spout and spew, which we shouldn't do anyway. Every legal system rests on a basic expectation. Citizens obey the laws made by the state. But what happens when a law itself is unjust, oppressive, or violates the basic dignity of the people it governs? And when we have a different question I see in this country, the imposition, as I've been for years, decades, watching, when the government doesn't do the law, it just acts, and there's no accountability for that lack of, for the malfeasance, the nonfeasance, misfeasance, the feasances, the feasance sisters. That's what we have as well. There may be a law, but it's not properly executed. Does the duty to obey still hold? Political theory has wrestled with the tension for centuries, producing one of the oldest debates in the discipline, the question of when or why resistance against the state becomes justified. This is not merely an academic puzzle. We know that because we see if we can trust the Declaration of Independence was something that then fomented the next step, the revolution, it has real consequences. Not just a debate, not just a puzzle to solve. And that's what I'm trying to go through here, inquire, get people to hear. There's a whole lot more than just an opinion relative to what it looks like we the people must seriously look at doing and then accomplish. It shapes how democracies handle dissent, how movements challenge bad laws, and how we judge the line between criminal lawbreaking and principled protest. What does resistance against the state mean? Resistance, broadly understood, refers to any action taken to oppose, challenge, or undermine the authority of the state. And let me interject right there, undermine the authority of the state. Well, there's a law which represents the authority of the people through the enactment of it, and there's a law that says one thing, and the official does not do that. What you're after is not the undermining of the state. And so it becomes very important that you identify what you're actually doing. It may not be even in the status here, undermining the authority of the state in an action that you're taking to stop the feasant sisters, I'll call them. And there's others. The breach of an oath. It can range from peaceful protest and petitioning to outright rebellion. So start listening for these words as well. They all have a definition, and this is where it becomes very important to get right. The central claim behind the right to resist is straightforward. The people of a nation are not obligated to suffer tyrannical rule and are entitled to reject a sovereign that fails to respect fundamental human rights. The idea has ancient origins across most major philosophical traditions, where it appears not just as a right, but often as a moral obligation to oppose an unjust ruler. Importantly, the right to resist is usually treated as a right of last resort. Well, I can't put a finer point on it than that statement right there, and this becomes the importance of it. It's the right to resist is the right of last resort. That means you have to document the failure of every other attempt before it and make sure that you had everyone accounted for. And you see that, as I said, in the Declaration of Independence. Political theorists described it as being triggered only in extraordinary circumstances of illegitimate government action. It does not give every aggrieved citizen license to defy any law they dislike. Rather, it activates when the state crosses a moral threshold, when its actions become so unjust that obedience itself would be a kind of complicity. Are people hearing this part right there? A kind of complicity with the Zionist political movement overtaking genocide and the complicity with that? The philosophical foundations of the right to resist, the justification for resistance is not a modern invention. It draws on a long lineage of thinkers who argued that the legitimacy of law depends on something deeper than the mere power to command. And I must interject here, those thinkers may or may not have been accurate, correct, or knew the totality of what needed to be known. You could be the next thinker, but you need to be able to really think well, critically think well on this stuff. You may have the new avenue, the new rationale. Because as you look through and you read enough court cases, it's, oh, just a theory. We're just living under a big theory. And I guess that's true. It's one that we all agree to at this point, and one that's gotten us here. And the question then is here serving us? Aquinas and the idea that an unjust law is no law. The medieval philosopher Thomas Aquinas built one of the most influential frameworks for thinking about unjust laws. Again, interject, influential framework, that your idea has to be able to support itself and gain people's agreeance. Remember last episode, it was talking about the populace has to agree. That's what perception management is about, isn't it? In his Summa Theologica, Aquinas argued the human law has the character of a true law only insofar as it is derived from the natural and divine law. When a law deviates from these higher moral standards, he held, it ceases to be a genuine law and becomes a perversion of law instead. This view is captured by the famous maxim lex iniusta non est lex. An unjust law is no law at all. It is worth noting a subtlety here that scholars often highlight. Aquinas himself appears to have been quoting an earlier formulation by St. Augustine rather than asserting it bluntly, and his actual position is more careful. And this highlights for what I was saying, time out of mind. People have been bringing up these ideas for a long time. It's very important to understand that lineage as well. He distinguished between laws that are unjust because they exceed authority or serve private interests, and laws that violate natural or divine order. The core takeaway, however, remains powerful. Laws that conflict with the requirements of natural law lose their power to morally bind citizens. Well, let's be very careful here. Morally bind citizens doesn't mean you're not going to be held for it. And that becomes the big harm. And that becomes the contention. Who's morally? Who's the influence that says what morally is? What it is. Locke and the natural right to resist tyranny. If Aquinas grounded a resistance in divine and natural law, John Locke gave it political and contractual foundation that would shape modern democracy. So interjecting on that, those of you who said you have no contract with the government, it likely came through the philosophies of Locke, and you want to look at that. It's going to be an unwritten contract that's imposed upon you, attaches to you. And so we got to be careful on the mechanics behind all that. At any rate, the readings of these folks that did this so-called thinking is what's important to start getting in your foundation, finding out what it worked, what didn't work, why might not it work? Are we facing different things that need a different foundation to be constructed? Do we need to talk to the point of rebellion? As I said, the Second Amendment, we did one, it's an internal civil war. That didn't get us where the South, would have wanted. And there's a lot of people that would have said that the South didn't have it right anyway. And so, again, that debate continues. And yet, we're an occupied people by the documentation. Is that how we want to live? We got us here. Is this where we want to continue? Writing in his second treatise on government in 1690, Locke argued that individuals possess natural rights, liberty, life, and property that exist before any government. And so we hear our founding fathers, correct? People form governments precisely to protect these rights. When a government instead violates them, the bargain is broken. Locke addressed the obvious worry heads-on. If rulers can resist whenever someone feels aggrieved, would this not collapse all order into chaos? And can't we see all that discussion right today in the Trump administration? Let them make chaos administration. His answer was precise. Force is to be opposed only to unjust and unlawful force. Resistance is not a tool for every minor grievance. He further developed a crucial distinction between the dissolution of government and the dissolution of society. When a tyrannical government collapses through the people's opposition, society itself does not dissolve. It persists and can establish a new legitimate government in its place. In a striking reversal, Locke argued that it is the rulers who break their trust and act against people, not the resistors who are truly guilty of rebellion. Resistance is not the same as civil disobedience. In this definition, while resistance is a broad umbrella term, civil disobedience is a far more specific and disciplined form of opposition. Confusing the two is a common mistake, and the distinction matters a great deal in political theory. And I'll say it matters a great deal in application. So we have to truly understand what we're dealing with in this matter. Defining civil disobedience. The most widely accepted account comes from the philosopher John Rawls. He defined civil disobedience as a public, nonviolent, and conscientious breach of law undertaken with the aim of bringing about a change of laws or government policies. Each word in this definition carries weight. The act in public rather than secretive, nonviolent rather than forceful, and conscientious rather than self-serving. What truly separates civil disobedience from ordinary lawbreaking is the principle of fidelity to law. And so here's another, there's so much to talk about what I'm going through here. I'm just reading through this really quickly, but these things come striking. The principle of fidelity to the law. This is where I hear people talking about there is no law. Well, you just eliminated your ability to continue because the system you're talking to thinks it's the law, and you're not operating from the principle of fidelity to a law, the moral part of it, to show that the system has gone wrong, if it has. People who engage in civil disobedience are willing to accept the legal consequences of their actions, and this acceptance demonstrates their respect for the rule of law as a whole. An ordinary criminal breaks the law to escape its consequences. The civil disobedient breaks a specific law openly and willingly faces punishment precisely to show they are not rejecting the legal order itself. Again, that's where you're looking at the spectrum. You may not feel that the existing government is wrong. You just know overall the authority is okay. There's something inside it that needs correcting. What we're looking at today is a total rejection of the government that has risen up within what we thought was not supposed to be, taking advantage the entire time. And that might be from the very beginning, once we get to a better understanding possibly of how this place was created. I'm talking United States. Although I'm talking internationally through this article. This article is from, we'll find out, India. They have the same questions there. They're looking at the same things going on. And people not wanting just to be the criminal to try and make change. Because that doesn't, the future of that, you act criminally, what you come, like fraud begets fraud. It's the same perpetuation. And as I said, we need to rise up and we need to do the better thing. It's not a capitulation to understand better, to do things a certain way that may not be the macho thing if it gets what we need. Questioning a law to strengthen the system. This points to the most important feature of civil disobedience. Those who practice it are not opposed to being bound by the law in general. They're opposed only to the content of a particular law. Let's say the passcode that was given that the government agent put in that wiped the phone. Could that be civil disobedience if he did it on purpose? Is there an accountability? Is it proper that that should be done? We're going to see. The guy's not arguing that the system was bad. He's arguing that there's a law within the system that's no good, and it's violating the purpose for that government and system. The goal is not to tear down the legal system, but to correct an injustice within it. And my view on this, on that point, is, okay, we got 1,000 injustices. How do we correct that? And the question then is there that many injustices in the right place that we do need to alter or maybe even abolish what has risen up around what started out to be something that seemed at least a good start? It was taken off track, and we the people allowed it, and we are to blame at part, but we are also duty-bound to get it back. How are we going to do that? What are we going to understand in ourselves? What terminology are we agreeing with? Who are we listening to in history, the ghosts of philosophers past? How are we going to solve the problems? Have they even been talked about yet? How unprecedented is the situation we're living in today that the philosophers of the past don't meet the demand, that we must create our own? And how are we going to then voice that and get that foundation laid that people understand it to the point that they will support it and in a majority sense? Civil disobedience occupies a careful middle ground, sitting between ordinary legal protests on one side and a revolutionary action or organized forcible resistance on the other. This is why the role of nonviolence is so central. Rawls and others argued that violent acts likely to injure others are incompatible with civil disobedience as a mode of communication. Thinkers such as Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. embodied this approach of nonviolent direct action. The reasoning is both moral and practical. Violence tends to obscure the message, breeds fear, and can lead the public to sympathize with the authorities rather than the victims of injustice. The Indian context, dissent within a constitutional democracy. For a constitutional democracy, these old debates take on a concrete legal form. The question becomes, how does the legal framework itself accommodate dissent and the challenging of unjust laws? Here, the right of protest serves as an institutionalized channel for exactly the kind of principled opposition that civil disobedience represents. The right to protest is not written as a separate clause in the Constitution. Instead, it is derived from Article 19, which guarantees the freedom of speech and expression under Article 19(1)(a) and the right of to assemble peacefully without arms under Article 19(1)(b). Together, these provisions allow citizens to gather and voice their dissent against the actions or inactions of the government. Nonviolent protest marches were, after all, a defining weapon in the freedom struggle, and that legacy is now woven into the constitutional protection. The judiciary has repeatedly affirmed this. In the Romelia Maidan case, the Supreme Court held that citizens have a fundamental right to assemble and peaceful protest that cannot be taken away by arbitrary executive or legislative action. Courts have consistently emphasized that the right to protest strengthens democracy by allowing citizens to hold those in power accountable. Where is that in the United States of America? Accountability. And this becomes the bigger problem if it's not available. Why is the right not absolute? Crucially, the right to protest comes with limits, which mirrors the conditions theorists place on resistance itself. Article 19(2) permits the state to impose reasonable restrictions on grounds such as the sovereignty, integrity of the nation, the security of the state, public order, and decency or morality. The right of the protesters must also be balanced against the rights of others. In the Mazdoor Kasing Shikati Sangathan case, the Supreme Court held that the right to protest had to be balanced with every person's right to life under Article 21, noting that fundamental rights do not exist in isolation. Again, start taking all these factors into consideration as we're thinking about what do we do with the problems that we see with our so-called officials. They're not really officials if they're outside the office, not doing the law, violating people, running their own scams. This legal balancing act reflects the same logic found in the philosophical tradition. Just as Locke insisted the resistance applies only to genuinely unjust force, and just as Rawls insisted that civil disobedience must remain nonviolent and accept legal consequences, the constitutional framework permits dissent while drawing limits to prevent it from sliding into disorder. Why this debate matters in democracy. The justification of resistance is ultimately about a deeper question. What keeps laws connected to morality? A legal system that demands obedience, regardless of justice, risks becoming an instrument of oppression. So this is a very important statement right there. The legal system that demands obedience, regardless of justice, risks becoming an instrument of oppression. If you look at the attorney generals of the states of the United States, one of the things they're supposed to protect against is oppression. And so that's one of the avenues you have to exhaust. You articulate the injustice that becomes that oppression. And when they don't respond, you've essentially checked that box in your steps toward the last resort. A society that permits resistance to any law risks descending into anarchy. The theory of justified resistance, refined over centuries, charts a path between these two dangers. In democratic societies, especially civil disobedience, functions as a vital corrective measure. It serves as a built-in pressure valve that allows citizens to flag injustices and push for laws that align with shared moral and ethical standards. And my question there is, do we want to push for more laws? All these laws haven't kept us from here. What brings justice is what we're after. More laws may not be it. I think we have enough laws, and they haven't been working. Far from being an attack on the state, principled disobedience can be a form of loyalty to the higher ideals the state is supposed to serve. By accepting punishment while challenging a specific law, the disobedient reaffirms the rule of law even as they demand it made be more just. And I would have to offer you, if you're sitting in the law, you're not disobedient to it. And that's what I suggest people do. You find the law, the black and white, you put yourself right where the law says you're supposed to be, and show how the miscreant in front of you, the official, needs to be made accountable. This is how the tradition reconciles two values that initially seem to clash, order and justice. And it explains why right to resist remains a permanent feature of serious political thought. Well, until you're in face of a cop, right? Right to resist. Don't do it there. What do you think? Where exactly should the line be drawn between legitimate resistance to an unjust law and a dangerous defiance to legitimate authority? And in a functioning democracy with elections and courts, what about a dysfunctioning democracy, even if we want to call it that, with election integrity at all here, folks? And in a functioning democracy with elections and courts, is breaking the law ever truly justified, or should all dissent be channeled through legal means? And I have a real serious problem with that word legal. When the system that you're looking at is the legal system, and you're watching it violate people. You're watching the branches beat people up. The root and branch was not taken down by we the people every 20 years. And I went through with some questions after reading a bit of that, and some thoughts, not too deep, just some thoughts that occurred to me regarding the right to alter or abolish, trying to refine it to see what it is you were doing, what the words are, the vocabulary that needs to be made and done and to be held and understood correctly. And I just asked, went to a duck and used their assistant and just got some quick responses just to kind of refresh my mind and test whether or not I remembered certain things. And also the AI could be wrong, so you got to be careful on this. So I'm not looking like making any set fast rules here. I'm going to now, like I suggested I was going to do last week, tell you, just go through some of my questions and what the responses are, and what it exposes to us, that our thoughts have to start forming in particular ways with certain guidelines and definitions and expectations, so that if there is a chance that we would alter, abolish, in whatever form we see fit as the people, we're properly doing so. And there is properness to it, even if it does turn out to be needing the last resort. My first question was, and you get links to these, you can probably see the answers. I think the duck will respond in the same answers that it gave me. It's, again, not definitive necessarily, just to get an idea. What is the exercise of the right to alter or abolish called? you know, definitions, they are expansive from one word. And so I'm wondering, is there a better word? I'm looking to see how do we position something we might want to act with and through. And it seems that it's not too many words that fill that bill. So that became an interesting view in itself. The exercise of the right to alter or abolish a government is called revolution. This concept is rooted in the belief that people have a right or duty to change a government that acts against their common interests or threatens their safety. So keep track of these and keep it a little bit loose. Hold to some of these facts as the standards, but notice some of the weaknesses within it as well. As we see, it's a belief. Well, someone else may not believe in that belief. Now we start to becoming more to the rubber meeting the road. When you're up against a government that won't believe that what you want to get done is correct. But the right and your duty is really more of a criminal act. So we have to understand the subtleties of this. But we do see a standard threatens their safety. That's one. That's one of the things the government's supposed to not allow to us. Not sure we can have a common interest, but I can sure find out whether or not our safety is threatened as I'm going through and trying to apply this in recent history, the last 5-10 years. The government been doing anything or not doing things that caused us to have our safety threatened. And we can expand that to our security, our health, and that. Let's move that over. But anyway, so here it is. The concept is rooted in a belief that people have the right or duty to change the government that acts against their common interest or threatens their safety. Second question I wanted to know about, is there a hybrid concept to exercising the right of collective mutual self-defense against systemic issues distinguished and the right of revolution? The assistant came back and said, yes, there is a hybrid concept that combines the right of collective mutual self-defense with the right of revolution, particularly in the context of addressing systemic issues. And it gave a chart, the relationship between the concepts, the collective self-defense issue and the right of revolution, and what are the relationships. In the nature of these remedies, collective self-defense is defensive action against oppression. In the right of revolution, it's the action to overthrow an unjust government. The focus for these concepts is collective defense is about protecting community rights and interests, while the right of revolution is about altering or abolishing oppressive systems. Relative to the context, collective self-defense is immediate threats to safety and rights, while the right of revolution is about long-term systemic injustices. The outcomes expected in collective defense would be preservation of community integrity, while the right of revolution is about establishment of a new political order. In conclusion, it writes and offers, the hybrid concept emphasizes that self-defense can serve as a form of political resistance. When communities collectively defend their rights, it may lead to revolutionary actions if systemic issues are not addressed. This approach highlights the interconnectedness of self-defense and revolutionary rights in the struggle against oppression. And so here we have the nugget, if you will, of how we would have to frame something moving forward if it's applicable. The third question I asked was, how is civil war distinguished from the right of revolution? A civil war is a conflict between organized groups within the same state, often for control or policy change, while the right of revolution refers to the belief that people have the right to overthrow a government that is unjust or oppressive. Essentially, civil wars are internal conflicts, whereas revolutions are aimed at establishing a new system of governance. I asked the fourth question of the assistant, the duck assistant, just duck, duck, go, type it in, question, the AI may come back. You can ask it to answer a question, if it will. How is civil war distinguished from the right of revolution in ignorant or apathetic populations, was my question. The answer that came back and offered, again, we have to qualify all this, if we will. Civil war typically refers to a conflict between factions within the same country fighting for control, Well, the right of revolution is the principle that the people can overthrow the government that they believe is unjust. In ignorant or apathetic populations, the distinction may blur, as individuals may not fully understand their rights or the implications of their government's actions, leading to confusion between the internal conflict and revolutionary action, which any conflict or confusion will be exploited by the wrongful acting government to defeat the people. And why we get the idea that the government wants a dumbed-down populace? The fifth question I asked was, how are acts of terrorism and exercising the right of revolution distinguished? And why would I ask that, except for what we've seen since 9/11? Everybody that's going to be doing any act is considered a terrorist. But we still have a right of revolution, right? Well, we do. So we have to be able to distinguish it from what the government would be called terrorism. And I've had to address this many times. The government will come back and call you now, since 9/11, a terrorist. They call you a sovereign citizen. The FBI has deemed that to be a terrorist. All right? They have all kinds of names for us. And you have to answer to that. And I answered to it, and I said, no, you've imposed a title that's not upon someone that's acting within the law to protect their rights and to protect against fraud, to protect against extortion, against coercion, to gain access to the courts. You're obstructing the courts by that. You have to have an answer. How are the acts of terrorism and exercising the right of revolution distinguished? In political philosophy, and again, someone's philosophy may not be your own. So we have some, these are not answers, these are things to inquire upon. In political philosophy, well, what other jurisdiction or venue of discussion might there be that they would throw at us? There's more to learn. In political philosophy, the right of revolution allows people to alter or abolish a government acting against their interests, while terrorism typically involves unauthorized violence by non-state actors that governments label as criminal. So you have to have that in your little toolbox. And I've answered to that in the government, where they come back and said, oh, we're a criminal. And all we were literally trying to do was get access to the courts. We wanted the right and correct court to hear the case. And there was a complaint filed without reason. They didn't come back and give us a reason why it was the wrong question. And it was the post office that did it. Kind of out of left field, don't you think? At any rate, we were asking for proper delivery. They called us a terrorist and brought the FBI in. And we had to answer that. And we answered it. And that shut them up. And this is the point right here. The government will come back and label us as criminals. What is our response? We have to understand what that has to be. And this is a whole lot more important than just answering to their suggestion that you might be a terrorist for asking them a question of something that you're intending to do lawfully. That's lawful for you to do. Because they're going to look at it, what you're doing is not lawful and not within the law, and you had another way to go. And you have to defeat all that in your response. And not just a response, in the perception of the response that people will pick up, those that may or may not fully understand. International law lacks a single definition for either concept, so distinctions often depend on whether the violence is framed as a justified struggle for self-determination or condemned as terrorism. So there's a framed issue again. So that became a very important question to remind me. I've already been involved in these things. The government's more than willing to come and do it. And this will be one of the higher aspects and points to have delineated that people fully and clearly understand. So the point here, whomever successfully frames that view, that perception, will win the general perception of that apathetic or ignorant population. Because they don't know more. And you watch how social media does that. You watch what's going on to make that so. Then I ask the sixth question. What is the initiation of self-governance called? So we heard self-governance before. I wanted to know a little bit more about that. And I wanted to get a current discussion about it. Just some place to start. Some place I could tell you. I wasn't really thinking about to say this on the broadcast, but I thought it was important after I read through what the answers. Given what we're seeing, given the importance of the oppression that's going on, the injustices that are going on from so many places, might we better start thinking on what we need to do and whether or not we can pull that off and what it's going to take, even if we can't go to the ultimate last resort. Maybe there's something short of that, in particular because of the comprehensive injustice that we're seeing. What is the initiation of self-governance called? The initiation of self-governance is often referred to as national sovereignty, which is a key concept in international law. So again, international review of this must be concurrent with what we're after. And the other idea here is all the people step up, not just your little thing you didn't like a law somewhere. No, this has to be a popular movement, if you will, a popular action. The population has to understand the people are the sovereignty, if you get that part here. And that's why they don't want us together. And I'm certainly speaking to everybody that ever thought they had a political party mind. We truly have to get out of that. If we see any injustices that are going up to cause oppression and whatever, all other injustice and the wrong acting of a government, and we maintain a party attitude, we don't deserve this place. I can just tell you that. We certainly aren't at the caliber of people that it needs to do, that it requires to do this. I asked the seventh question. Is the last one I decided I wanted to find out just for the short term that I was looking and had a focus on what I was thinking about. All in turn, as I'm looking through and thinking on all this, how is fighting systemic treason distinguished from revolution? Fighting systemic treason is often viewed as a response to a government that is perceived to be acting against the interests of its people, while revolution typically involves a broader and more organized effort to overthrow an existing government. The distinction lies in the intent and scale of the actions taken against perceived injustices. Perceived injustices. Why this tyrannical government, such as the U.S.-Israeli government, makes sure it dominates the perception management field. So these questions and their AI-assisted responses are but the most basic inquiry, just to kind of touch it a little bit. Much, much more needs to be understood as we begin to consider how to approach government gone bad, if you will. Or as the chief of Israel, Shin Bet, told Netanyahu about the Palestinians, he said, quote, "I told him the worst enemy is the enemy that he feels that he has nothing to lose. Because if he has nothing to lose, you lose the whole concept of deterrence," close quote. When will Americans finally decide they have had nothing to lose, to bring this ship of state back on course? When will we step up? What will it take? Are we too ignorant of people? Do we understand the most basic concepts? Are they rooted in somewhere that can cause people to feel and believe they can fight for that? And do they have a place, not to fight, just fight, but to make the better place? I told you last week, the revolution doesn't solve the problem. It allows potentially for the separation. There's more, and you have to look into the future quite a ways. That Second Amendment truly is a magnificent right that comes with such a heavy burden. It doesn't begin because you know how to fire the weapon and defend yourself or even overthrow a government. That starts it over again. And we got to do better. We better have a better mind about it. I'm hoping that we can. As we just saw now, the U.S. Senate did finally weigh in and rejects the SAVE Act as amendment in the budget reconciliation package. And I'm going to say, it didn't say anywhere in that rule, you didn't see anywhere in there in the revolution, in the rebellion, in the civil disobedience, none of it said vote harder. None of it. None of it said, oh, show your ID so you can be identified in the digital panopticon, Siberian gulag. None of it. But at any rate, and this is why I'm favorable on this point, even though I don't understand why it continued this way at all, except that it's bringing on the future that they want, and there's something not quite right about it. So they're taking some more time, where the state's representatives, even though you vote by the people, another adulteration to the original establishment, the U.S. Senate rejects SAVE Act, the SAVE Act, as amendment to budget reconciliation package. And that was interesting. So that SAVE Act by the Senate has been rejected where it was okayed by the House. U.S. senators voted 48-50 against adding the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act to a nearly $70 million reconciliation package on immigration, killing the bill Thursday afternoon. The act, which stated an intention of restricting participation in U.S. elections to citizens only, received bipartisan resistance. Uniparty resistance. Democrats raised concern over increased voting barriers for citizens, while some Republicans were wary of nationalizing elections. President Trump had expressed vocal support for the bill and pushed for the passage of the SAVE Act after its initial failure in April. The four Republican senators who voted against the bill are now facing backlash over their opposition to the act. Passed by the U.S. House of Representatives February 11th in a 218-213 vote, the act would have required documentary proof of U.S. citizenship to register for alleged elections. The registration card. Y'all know, need to go read that. You need to understand what the words are in that. U.S. citizenship to register for elections. Additionally, the bill would require voter identification when casting a ballot, limit eligibility for mail-in ballots, impose new restrictions on where voters can register, and require states to submit voter lists to U.S. Department of Homeland Security's controversial citizenship screening tool. There. Do people know now why it was a good thing this didn't pass? Or are we an ignorant people not worthy of our duties and obligations to alter or abolish Gov Gone Bad? In a February 9th press release, Michigan Attorney General Donna Nessel joined a coalition of 12 attorney generals who opposed the SAV Act and warned senators of the risks it posed. Quote, the SAV America Act is clearly an attempt to disenfranchise voters based on false claims of stolen or rigged elections, Nessel said. Quote, the legislation is not designed to protect democracy. What about the republic that we shall keep? But to make it harder for people to participate in it, and I urge the Senate to reject the SAVE America Act and uphold the fundamental right to vote, close quote. But that is not why. That is the political cover story. It would require people to digitize themselves to be worthy. Do people understand the difference between what the real ID with its servitudes does and their state ID does? Yeah, I don't think so. And Trump says China do it? Yeah, I don't think so. I think even Massey, I told you, Massey has this wrong. Oh, there's nothing different between the real ID and your state. And oh, there's a lot different. And it's attached to all this. And the real ID has the biometrics and everything else and the international harmonization and on. But not so anonymous, is it? Despite voting, the amendment would not have passed the Senate due to a lack of qualifications under the Byrd Rule. The rule determines that what legislation can be passed during a budget reconciliation process and excludes non-budget related policy changes, such as the SAVE Act. So, this whole thing has been more kabuki theater, and they sent in the trial balloon clowns. And so to look at this again, the Declaration of Independence didn't say we voted harder to be here. And this SAVE Act is one of these types of bills that eventually gets people in to be part of the system. If they turn the digital system, the gulag, into the thing that the government actually sees works, like they're trying to do, like they're trying to like go digital. Once that works, then this thing, whole thing shifts. We said that everyone should be wanting to get in it. But this case, it's to vote harder. I think this is a distraction on many, many, many levels when you start thinking about the abuse that's going on, the injustice that's going on, the oppression that's going on, the self-interested profiteering that's going on, and whom it goes to for the most part in a nation that was supposed to be limited in that front end where law was supposed to work to bring accountability. When all that ceased to exist, I think it brought the question of altering and abolish the system in whatever, through whatever spectrum of application into a need of analysis. The SAVE Act wouldn't do that. It would just get people to want to vote harder in the same system that's not serving them. And I don't know what more to say about that or to do about that. So we can pick our poison, I guess. This would be in the system doing what won't work for us some more, which actually brings on the international system, which is, we won't see it international because it's digital. And that's going to be at everybody's fingertips through these phones and AI enhanced. And we're watching now the admission of what AI can't be. Well, it can't be constrained. It's a black box that no one really understands and can't tell it no. Like, we don't have the power of the power cord, I guess, anymore. And I guess we won't once the AI surveillance, I mean, data centers are hooked up to nuclear power plants. Isn't that interesting? And the world starts working on the expertise of an AI that no one knows that really how to use. Well, maybe those kids in China, remember? They're being told how to use AI. Their system is actually saying, we want you to know how to use AI, and when you go through your studies and you want to become an engineer, you don't have to do the tests. If you design something, you invent something and it works for utility in the world, you've passed your tests. So that's the kind of R&D I like to hear about. That's the kind of world I was brought up into. Your instructors were telling you the rudiments so that then they gave you, they let you go into the room and they said, here's the lab. Go find something to make. You know, go do something. You have the creativity to pull it off. And a lot of us did. Problem is, it still got us here in the United States, where now China looks like a revolution. Their revolution is a little bit different in that it's now focused, and there's well over a billion people focused on that intention. Where's the intention of the people of America? If you can't find one, then you know that's our future. So I went through today a little bit about just the cursory look at what is this thing called the right to alter or abolish? Are we there yet? I mean, what part of the spectrum? Do we just do the basic challenges? Do we do a little bit more? Do we do civil disobedience in certain areas? Do we have our ducks in a row a lot better to make that accomplished? Or do we keep pushing even further? And we have to push a bit further to exhaust all those sub-remedies. And we get to the attorney generals of the same states that talked about here and gave the warning of the SAVE Act. And we say, here, you want to talk about oppression and defenselessness? Here's our cause. Here's the thing that you need to change before we start changing it. And that would likely, I would think, be one of the last steps that would have to be done. There's a few steps before that. And I'm saying that with a little bit of knowledge about how I started to progress with the mining claim and the violations that we were seeing. I started out with my complaints to the agents. They kept violating. I wrote a complaint, a 54-page criminal complaint, sent it to the sheriff. The sheriff didn't act, so I'm now moving up the ladder. My next place to go was the attorney general on the failure of the sheriff not upholding the law. In a position, in a condition that caused oppression and defenselessness, the very duty that's written in the statute, the black and white, for that agent. However, I would conceive of them, and the attorney general of the state, and even though people don't have direct access, so through the duties you do, I was exhausting that. So I'm moving on up the ladder here of all the things that we've done in order to avoid being oppressed, made defenseless, and to follow the law, have the government follow the law. Never got to fulfill that with the condition that happened to me. With the situation here. But that was on tap. I was following what we were reading here today in a different way. Going through the system that is the way it's written to exhaust all those steps to one day say, and it wasn't going to come too far, maybe a couple more years of addressing this, to say, I've exhausted my remedies. You're now committing crimes that are no accountability and you're causing harm. And that kind of a case, the way it was being written, would show that that applies to all people across the nation and all properties. And if every state, everybody picked it up in the states and went to their attorney general, and they found the same duties, and the attorney generals wouldn't work. Like, you see, they can. They can when they want to. And you point that out. As I was showing you, you go through the Admissions Acts to see the duty of the state to protect private property. And the private property is protected by the ultimate evidence of what is it contained in that property and the rights appurtenant, and that's the patent. And how many properties in this country have one? But every one that was granted property, disposed by the law, by the federal law or state law, every one you see that's out there, that's not been ceded to the government or kept back. And so there's these things I speak about behind the woodshed. Move us through the steps. I read today there's distinction between all these terminologies that we have to understand if we're going to get serious. I'm speaking ahead of the time and kind of putting a bug in people's ear. If you're going to start getting serious about being disgruntled about the injustice you see, there's a process. I'd say get to it. Get to it now. And then you need to team up, and you need to be a mass big enough, doing the right things with the right words and the right defenses as you go, with the right discussion on who's not doing what they're supposed to do, because I think that's where this goes. This goes with the lack of act of government that we're supposed to. They do plenty to destroy us. They don't do much to protect us. So it's an omission to act, where the law provides the duties. I keep talking to you about that. How to identify it, to identify it. Here we have the Attorney General stepping up. They show how it's not right. They have their reasons. It persuaded the senators. But we have, as a people, we see the injustice of even that system and those Attorney Generals on top of what they've done. Even though this one, for this time, saves us a little bit of time relative to voting harder and being promoted to vote harder instead of looking at the hard decision to alter or abolish. That's what the problem is here. You're being persuaded down the road, kicking the can against doing what we the people really need to do. And I'm not here to say any one thing. I don't really know. I have my ideas. But until the mass of people get involved and the mass of that people are intelligent, informed, understand that the procedures that even are unwritten, though they're talked about in history as we read, the philosophers of old, and even those may not be good enough for us today. When we have worked that through, then maybe we're ready. This has been BTW RLM 679, and I'll be with you next week. Tech Tips, or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Thunder piercing free. Pull up a chair, lean in close. Lessons to learn, dose by dose. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. House words ignite, the airwaves burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. Law to liberty, the spectrum light. In house court, no place to hide. To burst for unspoken truths and unquenchable thirst. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. House words ignite, the airwaves burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. So mark the time when Sunday comes. Behind the woodshed, beating drums. House voice, a beacon, fierce and bold. Fight the truth. So mark the time when Sunday comes. Behind the woodshed, beating drums.
the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.